Welcome to the 110th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chatt.
And in the week when two disgraced Australian cricketers rejoined their side, welcome to the podcast, still looking for any team that will have them.
Yes, this is indeed the homeless podcasting cricket team based across, the only inter-hemispherical podcasting cricket team based across Sydney and London. And this episode, we are going to be surveying cricket the world over. We're going to be looking at that quite historic, I suppose, Afghanistan-Ireland test match that's just finished. We'll be looking at the start of the English cricket season, the county season coming up. Andy's going to be telling us from the archives, From Scorpions to Falcons is the title of that. And we'll obviously hear more about that fascinating title when the time comes. And then we have been reviewing as well what I think I'd describe as a mighty tome, which is Arlott Swanton and the Soul of English Cricket. So, Andy, Afghanistan Island, and you actually got to watch quite a lot of this, didn't you?
So there are not many things that will get me out of bed at 3:30 a.m. on a Saturday morning, but for the first time in a while, I joined the fine team of Guerrilla Cricket to watch what was indeed a bit of cricketing history. So the two new entrants to Test cricket, both looking for their first Test win. I think the thing that was really striking was how much it evidently meant to everyone involved. So to give a couple of examples, you have Tim Murta, now 37, long-term county cricket servant, playing Test cricket, representing Ireland, clearly towards the end of his career, but you know, meaning so much to him. There was another extraordinary moment when Ramat Shah came so close to becoming Afghanistan's first Test centurion and was dismissed on 98. And the cameras panned across to the Afghan senior official in the crowd who looked distraught. And again, it was just a reminder of quite what this means. The other thing was the quality of the contest. So I think it's very easy, and I think as cricket fans and cricket journalists have long been very patronising of sort of new entrants to the game. You know, we've done it to Bangladesh in the past, for example. This was a really good test match. You know, Afghanistan won, and in the end won, I think as you'd expect on their conditions, relatively comfortably, but it was a really good contest. Lots of back and forth, good match between bat and ball, and a great advert for the expansion of the game. I mean, so much has been said about the ICC's unwillingness or cautiousness around doing more to bring associates into the game. This is one area where they were bold. They gave Afghanistan and Ireland their status. I mean, I guess some, I'm sure quite a few Irish fans would say, you know, it took them a while. But this was a great advert for that expansion. Two teams playing high quality cricket, caring about it. And I also thought it may be a challenge in the coming years for Afghanistan and Ireland to get the games they deserve at Test level. But actually, at the worst case scenario, maybe we've seen the start of a rather fun little rivalry, because I think we can imagine the two of them playing each other a fair bit in the years to come. And that'll be no bad thing.
Well, it's always been the case with, say, you mentioned Bangladesh, but there was sort of that case with Bangladesh and Zimbabwe that they were the only two test-playing nations that could realistically kind of beat one another, and whenever they played anyone else, they got thrashed. And what's quite nice is to see, well, I don't know, do we see the development here of a second tier of test-playing nation with Afghanistan and Ireland in the mix there, where we're not actually expecting them to go out and be, you know, beating Australia and England and India week in, week out, but actually that we can be happy with them playing one another and they're happy playing one another? Or do you think that what this naturally leads towards is they need to be thrown in with everyone else and need to make their own way there? Because it seems to me that latter model has never quite worked.
It's that eternal balance, isn't it? You know, that they need the cricket to improve against the bigger sides to improve, but in the meantime they will probably take some shellackings. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind Ireland debuted very impressively in Test cricket back last year in Malahide, where they gave Pakistan one hell of a fright. And I think both of these sides will be a real prospect, a real sort of challenge on home turf. I think Ireland on an overcast day in Dublin will be tough, and I think Afghanistan, Dehradun, which is in India, which is sort of kind of becoming their home ground, I think will be tough in those conditions. So I think they'll certainly be able to give teams a game. It's impossible to watch this and not get excited about the one-off test later this summer where Ireland will play England at Lord's. I think there'll be great atmosphere. And I think while it's a huge ask for Ireland, I'm sure they will be able to give England a contest. So maybe I think in the short term, some of those shorter series might be the way forward.
And it's also always the case that teams only grow once you put them into that position. So Ireland was only going to grow into a good test playing nation once it started playing test cricket, which I suppose was a lot of the frustration about delaying that entry into test cricket for quite a long time, is that they couldn't actually develop the players while they weren't playing test cricket. So a lot of the kind of development curve, as it were, will start happening now.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for strengthening the game, if you're watching this as a sort of aspiring sportsman, this is a great way to get and encourage people into cricket. It's a great way to point to say, you know, if you're an Irish cricketer in your young 20s, you can see a way forward here. You can see a career sort of coming out in front of you that may not have been as clear a couple of years back.
Now, well, maybe we should both be dusting off the Irish passports.
Well, yes, that is something that an awful lot of people in the UK have been doing, dusting off or actively hunting for. Now, away from the expansion of the test game, you've been looking forward, but also chuckling at a bit of sort of Australian gamesmanship.
Yeah, so I was just a brief aside that some people may have seen. I was quite amused by the attempt of one Australian club side up in Queensland to manipulate the standings in their league, whereby they were playing a game against the strongest team in the league, and this team had put 675 on the board in the first innings. And so this other side decided that in order to give the other side the number of bonus points whereby they weren't going to play them in the semi-finals of the league, that they needed to just completely capitulate. So they declared on 14 runs in their first innings in response to 675. And, you know, this is in bright sunshine, so it's not sort of typical declaration cricket in any way whatsoever. But I just thought it was quite amusing that they ever thought they could get away with that. And of course they've, you know, they've been reprimanded for being outside the spirit of the game. But it's just always quite funny when people try to cheat, I suppose, is effectively what it is. There's that hilarious video that I hope everyone's seen of the cricketers in, I think it's in the UAE, where there's a match fixing going on and they all conspire to capitulate whilst batting in the most hilarious possible ways, and they're just not good actors. They try to look as if they're really sad when they're out, but clearly they're not sad at all.
It's also fascinating how an example of cheating in Australian club cricket ends up as a sort of international news story, isn't it? It must be a shock to all those involved when they find themselves being discussed. I quite like the tokenness of 14 runs as well. You know, they didn't go out there and sort of score one, or they didn't go out and sort of make a respect, but 14 feels like a very bizarre point at which to declare. But
it looks like that they weren't quite sure about at what point they should declare, as if they thought that, you know, declaring on one would be too obvious, but declaring on 14 would make them look like, oh, it was just a bad declaration in some way. You know, if you get to 14 chasing 675, then maybe that is a reasonable declaration. You never know. Put them in again, bowl them out cheaply, and get out and chase down the runs. But the other thing that obviously it's we're heading into autumn here in Australia, but you're about to launch into the spring in England, and it's an interesting county season that's coming up, and it's an interesting county season that's coming up because of what's happening next year in 2020. So in 2020, of course, excuse me, that the 100 is being launched, the all new singing and dancing form of cricket that is, according to the ECB, going to, you know, save the game for future generations. And the effect of knowing that this thing is coming in 2020 is that the 2019 season already feels like a bit of an antique. It already feels slightly outdated in some way.
Well, what it certainly is doing is the amount of debate on the 100, both sort of amongst fans and just sort of on Twitter and everything, you're quite right, is completely steamrolling an awful lot of the preview of the season ahead, which I think is, you're quite right, I think it is sort of having an extraordinary influence. I think many people are still in denial about it, which I must admit I think is sort of the camp I find myself in.
Well, it's going to change a lot, and I hadn't quite realised how much it's going to going to change until I was looking at the layout of the county season for 2020 when the 100 kicks in. So the actual, the four-day format of the championship actually gets relegated to the edge of the season. The 50-over format, I was reading, there'll be no overseas players in the 50-over format. That will now be very much seen as a breeding ground for new cricketers, which I think, I mean, I've always been a huge fan of one-day cricket, and I think that's a real pity. But what's most amusing is that suddenly 2020 seems outdated. So 2020 is basically the warm-up for the 100, and it's actually the opportunity that players have to show their, you know, to strut their stuff so that they can then be brought into one of the 100 teams later in the season. So there is a really, really fundamental rethink of how the county game is happening. So this summer, when you're watching cricket in England, you know, you watch it thinking this will be the last of its kind. From the archives, and for this episode, Andy has prepared a rather intriguing sounding feature for us. From Scorpions to Falcons, the curious tale of a cricketing nickname.
So let's go back 20 years, and at that point the ECB were plotting a renovation of English cricket. It wasn't the 100 this time upsetting people, it was the National League, a new limited overs tournament. Now, in order to whip up a bit of hype, the ECB's marketing team had a master plan. Every county needed to pick a nickname. Now, for some clubs, this was easy. So Warwickshire, for example, had long been the Bears. So Warwickshire Bears was very natural. And similarly, Leicestershire were widely known as the Foxes. But for plenty of counties, they didn't have a sort of obvious, widely used nickname. Derbyshire was one of those counties who faced a conundrum. Their crest has a golden rose on it, but the Derbyshire Rose is... just didn't quite fit this new all-action, all-singing and dancing tournament. So Derbyshire took quite a bold step. They gave up on any sentiment whatsoever and fully embraced the spirit of commercialism. They went with a scorpion. Now, the only reason they had for that was because it was the name of a lager produced by a sponsor, a brewery who was sponsoring them. And I think you can actually say that by going purely commercial, by doing it purely for the money, they were actually ahead of their time. If you look at the IPL, for example, where, you know, you have all sorts of extraordinary names, but to give you just one example, the Sunrisers Hyderabad, who the Sunrisers are named after the Sun TV network in India, for example.
Oh, so, I didn't know that. Yeah. I thought it was because they all got up early to do their training, you know, that they were all kind of up at dawn in the gym and in the nets. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because that anecdote about the, which I just think is absolutely great, about Derbyshire having a rose on their crest but not wanting to call themselves the Derbyshire Roses. When you give yourself a name, that name does say quite a lot about you. It needs to be quite chantable as well for the crowd, but it also needs to be something that you can rally around in some way. And so actually, yes, it's a marketing thing, but it also, like, names do define who you are and define the, you know, what you want to be as a club. So it's no small matter when the ECB decided that everyone should have a nickname, trying to decide what that name was.
Absolutely. I think this is this weird process, isn't it? You pick a name that in some way represents you, but actually once you pick that name, the name probably impacts back on you. You know, it's sort of, you know, you get into this thing in fiction around, like, nominative determinism, characters, yes, who play up to their names and things. You know, ask any school teacher who will look at the register before the start of a year and pick out the children they think are going to be naughty. There's a lot in a name. Now, Derbyshire had made life very easy for headline writers. Over the next few years, we were treated to such classics as Cork stings the scorpions, Shoaib takes the sting out of the scorpions, Northants impervious to scorpions' sting. You'll see that.
And what's amusing about all of those is that none of them are the scorpions stinging someone else. Every single one of those is the scorpions being victim to their own sting. So even though they came up with something that was, you know, potentially quite a useful name, it actually, exactly as you say, ended up kind of rebounding on them in some way.
And the Telegraph spotted this, and they went in with perhaps the cruelest assessment, where they said it was appropriate that the club should have named their Sunday league side after an animal famed for committing suicide. Perhaps some of these negative headlines and the general lack of success, frankly, as Scorpions, played into Derbyshire's decision to, in the winter of 2004, change names. They also had another very simple reason, which was that the brewery sponsor had gone out of business, so this link that had always been a bit tenuous was now completely non-existent. They decided they were going to have a new name which did have a direct relationship to Derbyshire, and they got a local radio station to help. As an aside, I think this is a very brave move, because you think of recent decisions, things like Boaty McBoatface in the UK, you know, when you ask the public for help with names, it can go wrong. They ended up as the Derbyshire Phantoms. Now, the justification for this is that Derby is one of the UK's most haunted cities. I was very sceptical of this, but a bit of research suggests that actually a lot of people do agree with this. None more vociferously than the Derbyshire Tourist Board, who described Derby as, I quote, the dead centre of the UK. So there you go.
Do you remember before the 2005 Ashes? Do you remember... that was up in Durham. One of the Australian batsmen.
Yeah.
One of the Australian batsmen getting scared in a... Sorry, anyway, that was in Durham. But anyway, Phantoms obviously have a rich history in cricket.
Indeed, and I think this felt like an improvement. They also sort of spread their bets by saying that not only was it because Derby was haunted, but that there was a link to Rolls-Royce, who make the famous Phantom car. They've long had a factory in Derby. Unfortunately, Smart Alec soon pulled this argument apart, because apparently cars haven't actually been produced in Derby since 1946. So there you go. Their PR team excelled themselves, because the announcement made quite a splash, but mainly because a technical fault meant that many recipients of the press release got not just one email, but in some cases as many as 7,000. And you can imagine feeling quite negatively about the Derbyshire Phantoms by the time you get to email 7,000 announcing their arrival.
Do you know what? All of this is straight out of, there's a TV show in Australia called Utopia, which is about all the things that go on in an office in terms of, you know, ridiculous marketing speak and team building exercises and all of those other things. And this whole escapade around naming club sides is straight out of one of those, the office in the UK. It's absolutely straight out of one of those situations, isn't it?
And I think perhaps, and I mean this with no disrespect to Derbyshire, but I think it partly reflects maybe a county that is a little bit smaller, has maybe not got the sort of monster, and this is no bad thing, there's no sort of monster PR machine behind it that might have been a bit more cautious about some of these names. Anyway, come 2009 and they're at it again. I would love to tell you more about why Derbyshire changed the name, but there is an utter lack of information online, which I think also suggests perhaps a general lack of interest in the subject. They did stick with a local connection, but this time it was a slightly different one. They became the Derbyshire Falcons because of the peregrine falcons that famously nest in Derby Cathedral. It may not surprise you to know that the Derby Cathedral Peregrine Project described the decision as a delightful surprise. And at any rate, it has stuck. So 10 years on, in one day competition, Derbyshire remain the Falcons.
And it must be the case that if you're a fan of Derbyshire through this period, you're not ever quite sure what to chant when you're in the stands. You're never quite sure what the name is, or if you want to give a spontaneous cheer, you're not actually sure what your club's called, which can't be a particularly helpful situation to be in.
I also imagine it's created a nice line in collectible memorabilia. You know, a sort of Derbyshire Phantom shirt must now be a bit of an item, or perhaps not. I don't know how competitive the field is for Derbyshire memorabilia. As of 20 years on from this experiment, several clubs have ditched nicknames entirely. So we no longer have the Middlesex Panthers, the Gloucestershire Gladiators, or even the Somerset Sabres. All of these clubs are just back to their single county names. Derbyshire seems stuck in this halfway house, which is common, I think, of quite a few counties, where they've not gone to the lengths of actually giving up the name, but it sort of just sits there awkwardly. They don't really actively promote it. So, for example, you go on Derbyshire County's Twitter page and there's no mention of the Falcons. I think this whole experiment reflects a little bit what happens when you take American-style sports marketing and combine it with a game like cricket, with obviously an awful lot of tradition, a lot of a strong history of kind of doing things its own way, you end up with a bit of a mess. And I think it's fair to say that it's a mess that's not had a great impact, negative or positive. I don't think it's driven fans away from the game. I doubt it's incentivized many to come. Matthew Engels, I think, was quite perceptive when this was first launched back in 99, when he said, "It's harmless but rather sad," which I think probably is a rather neat summary. Derbyshire, however, I do think deserve a bit of credit. They were given this mad idea and they embraced it fully. And in the process, they've created their own rather strange little bit of cricketing history. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading Arlott, Swanton and the Soul of English Cricket by Stephen Fay and David Kynaston. This was published in April last year. Stephen Fay is a former editor of the Wisden Cricket Monthly. David Kynaston is a historian with a staggering volume of work behind him, including a four-volume history of the City of London. He's someone we're familiar with on the podcast, because we reviewed his book WG's Birthday Party back in episode 51. Toby, how would you summarise this as a book?
Well, interestingly, on the cover, they know how to go straight to our hearts by quoting Mike Brearley, your recent friend, who says this beautifully written social history of cricket is a pleasure to read. And I think social history is something that's really, really key to this, because the lifespans of Arlott and Swanton, you know, cover a very changing time in the history of Britain, and they come from, as the authors are very keen to point out, they come from different social backgrounds. So in a way, this is a bit of a social history of Britain. It's also a social history of cricket during the throughout much of the 20th century, in the way that the game changes, particularly over some quite seismic changes in the game. But it's also a bit of a dual biography of these two very significant cricket commentators that changed the way that we think about cricket commentary, and the way that cricket is commentated to people now in the 21st century. I think so. It takes us through from really their life stories from cradle to grave.
And the real focus is two sort of real great thinkers about the game, great commentators, writers about the game, making sense, as you say, of a changing era. And I think the sort of signature idea of the book is the way that Arlott and Swanton, to some extent, were great conservatives, to some extent were very nostalgic for a golden age. Swanton at one point says, "People think I'm rather wet and soft, but there was a wonderful feeling and fellowship about the game, which I fear we can never recapture." There's that spirit of nostalgia throughout. And yet, at the same time, they both surprise you, I think, with their openness to change. So, for example, we have Swanton actively pushing for the introduction of one-day cricket. We have Arlott worrying about packet cricket, but at the same time very much defending and pushing players' rights to earn what they can earn. So I think it's that balance in that game, that balance between nostalgia and passion for what it was, but also a surprising openness, I think, in the case of both men, to its future and the way it changed.
And certainly one thing that is one seismic change that happens during the course of this book is the end of amateurism, particularly in the 1960s, when there are a lot of debates and the topic is a very live one. What this book, I think, does really well is, by seeing it through the eyes of Arlott and Swanton, you get a real sense of all of the complexities that happened in that debate. Because I think now we look back on that as people who didn't live through it in the 21st century, and you sort of know that at one point amateurism ended in cricket and it turned professional, and now we have the game that we have. And it was actually through reading this book that you really get a sense of the kind of contradictions, and also the way in which it impacted on individuals within the game. There's a brilliant anecdote about Ken Barrington, who's a professional, scoring 109 in 7 hours while the rest of the England team was collapsing around him, and Swanton describes it as the personification of the modern, coldly efficient, hyper-professional performance. And suddenly Ken Barrington finds himself being co-opted into this debate around whether professionalism is a good thing or not, and whether the game still needs amateurism. Well, so it actually brings quite a lot of those debates to life, I think.
And Swanton is uncomfortable actually about the end of amateurism, and his defence is quite interesting. He talks about this idea of the players we might lose from the game, which in hindsight I think is sort of feels like a very strange argument, but maybe made more sense at the time. I think another thing that is really striking in the kind of political climate we are in now is that we define people very strongly in terms of their beliefs. And you look at Swanton and Arlott and you realise that a lot of people do not fit natural, easy categories. So there's the example of South Africa's cancelled tour to the UK, where Swanton takes against the tour and he loses friends over it because, you know, his more conservative friends see him as a traitor, you know, for having kind of let down. And it's a good reminder that it can be very lazy to sort of see, you know, Swanton, the kind of fuddy-duddy conservative, but who stood up to some extent, you know, against apartheid and against studies. And I think a good reminder that none of these people, defining people too clearly or as simply by a single system of belief, often leads you to make a lot of mistakes.
One of the things that I enjoyed about this book is the fact that it is very well written. And one of the things that it benefits from is the eloquence and erudition of Swanton and Arlott in terms of being able to quote them. And there are some quite long passages that are quoted, you know, throughout the book from both of those, both in terms of transcripts of their broadcasting, but also of their writing. And one of the things that was quite interesting for me to read was the way that during this period, and particularly with Arlott, who was not someone who spoke with received pronunciation, was not someone who was from the establishment, how actually he was... he went into broadcasting very much at the time when there was a move towards people with regional voices being accepted and actually welcomed by the BBC, and he was a bit of a trailblazer in that sense. And the reason why he was able to blaze that trail was because he was first and foremost a man of radio. So he actually started off his radio life as a producer of a poetry program, a very impressive poetry program with a very impressive list of guests that happened there. Dylan Thomas is a regular. Dylan Thomas writing in saying, "I'm a bit poor this month. Can you have me on so I can get paid a fee?" Which I just thought was a brilliant thing. But one of the results of that is that when you're reading this book, you get wonderfully phrased descriptions of some quite timeless beliefs around cricket. So we were talking earlier in this podcast about, you know, the nature of cricket moving on with the 100 and, you know, county sides being given ridiculous games names. And there's this wonderful quotation from Arlott, which is this: "It would be a shame if, for the sake of the non-enthusiast's problematical gate money, the game the enthusiast follows were ever debased. The marginal spectator might come once to see cover points fielding on roller skates, but he would not return. And when he went out, he would be followed by the old regulars," which is just something as a statement that is seems pretty timeless in the way that we talk about cricket now.
Absolutely. I mean, you could write this in an article on the 100 today unchanged, and you would be making the same point. I have to ask you about another Arlott quote. As an adopted Australian, what did you think of his downbeat nature on your adopted country, terming it a dull country, people much of a hearty sameness, and none of the things that interest me available in more than driblets? I love the word driblets, by the way. No second-hand bookshops, bare bones of worthwhile architecture, no pottery, no glass, no pictures. Being a bit tough on Australia?
He was an uncompromising man, wasn't he? I mean, given that I live with someone who's a potter, I get to see my fair bit of pottery, and I've been to a few secondhand bookshops. But no, absolutely, I can see how someone like, with the kind of misty-eyed view of the world, like Arlott did, who clearly loved some of the more nostalgic parts of England, how he might have been challenged by Australia in the 60s and 70s. So what's your verdict on this book?
I think one of the book's strengths and weaknesses is its thoroughness. We hear Arlott and Swanton's views on almost everything that happened during their time, and it gets to a point where I think sometimes it's too thorough. I mean, do we need their views on sort of every particular game, every particular test? I also wonder a little bit about them as a pairing. I mean, they were clearly preeminent cricketing figures of their age, but they're not a completely natural pair. They were never close friends. They were never really fierce rivals. But I think what the book does give you is an attempt to understand, to see two very brilliant men trying to navigate their own complex love affair with the game. So they're trying to help it change while also protect what makes it special. And I think, as you say, with the 100 or with 2020 or with admitting new teams to test cricket, that's a debate that never goes away.
So that was Stephen Fay and David Kynastons, Kynastons, sorry, David, I don't know how to pronounce your name, Arlott Swanton and the Soul of English Cricket, published by Bloomsbury, very, very available from, you know, wherever you get your books. And that was the 110th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Thank you, as ever, for joining us. And we'll be back in a few more weeks with more cricketing goodness.